Welcome to Three Associating.
One is the loneliest number.
A podcast that goes behind the door of therapists working in a relational psychoanalytic model. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Rachel. We're both therapists.
And we're both supervisees of Jill.
And I'm Jill, therapist and supervisor, and co-author with Jackie Winship of the book The Talking Cure.
While people might think that therapists have it all together, by now you know we don't. We get stuck, experience challenges, and have blind spots.
This continues to affect our work, and this is why we need ongoing supervision.
This podcast peeks behind the closed door of relational supervision and lets you know about the therapist's blind spots. Relational supervision complements the traditional focus on the patient by focusing on both patient and the therapist.
In each episode, we discuss a fictitious character in supervision. While none of these patients are real, the relational dynamics are.
One is the loneliest.
Episode 5. One Shush! When talking is the problem and not the cure. One is the loneliest number. Hey, Rach, have you ever been in your own company for a while and then you finally go out and get asked by, say, the person at the supermarket checkout, how are you? And then you find yourself just unable to stop talking and giving a detailed blow-by-blow description of your day and...
You realise 5 sentences in, you are meant to just say, fine, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Andy.
So today I'm going to bring to you a patient who I'm going to name Martha. And she's in her late 40s, and I've seen her for fortnightly sessions for the last 9 months. I suggested weekly sessions initially, but she said she couldn't afford that, both in terms of money and time, so we meet fortnightly. And my first association to my work with Martha is the Wall of Sound, which was the music production formula that was pioneered by Phil Spector in the 60s. And I actually... That's kind of what I associate to her. And I was just reading about it the other day and I read a quotation from Spector where he describes the formula by stating, he says, I was looking for a sound so strong that if the material was not the greatest, the sound would carry the record. And I feel like Martha is the wall of sound. So let me tell you more. So she came to therapy feeling anxious and depressed. She said she was exhausted and stretched to breaking point on account of having no time and no space for herself. She's been married to her wife for 10 years and they have 2 children each from previous relationships. So 4 children altogether in the family. There's a 19-year-old, 2 17-year-olds and a 13-year-old.
Just how old is Martha? Sorry.
Martha's late 40s.
Late 40s.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Martha feels that everyone in her blended family relies on her, and this frustrates her and leads to resentment. So she bemoans carrying all of the mental load of the household, and she also often talks about feeling taken for granted and overlooked by her wife. And Martha says it's impossible for her to find any kind of voice in her family. She describes being unable to take time for herself or to engage in any self-care, and she says that she has this tendency to prioritize everyone else's needs above her own and that this has detrimental effects on her mental health, her physical health. She says she feels really guilty and ashamed if she attends to herself ever. And she also says that she's driven by her family to drink much more alcohol than she wants to. She, even prior to this blended family, she had a difficult relationship with alcohol, in her words. And so she became sober for most of her 30s, but she then developed a habit of shoplifting and she got caught shoplifting. And so then she stopped shoplifting and started drinking again. Although I'm skeptical about whether she's totally stopped shoplifting. Anyway, Martha, she describes growing up in a household with 5 older siblings and the details aren't clear, but I have an impression of this sort of noisy, chaotic household in which people are constantly coming and going and everyone is talking at each other rather than to each other. And she describes her childhood as traumatic, but again, the details are fuzzy. From what she said, I gather there was a fair bit of domestic violence in the household, perpetrated mainly by the father and especially after he'd been drinking, and mainly towards the mother. Sometimes towards the children as well, I think. Martha talks fondly of her father, even though he died when she was in her late teens. And there's also some, it's like an uncle or a family friend, or there's some older guy somewhere who's sort of hanging around the family picture who sounds like he was pretty skeezy, and there's sort of a question mark there for me around some sort of sexual abuse, sexual assault, something sort of inappropriate with Martha and maybe some of her siblings too. What I'm struggling with the most in my work with Martha is her talking, because Martha talks and talks and talks and talks. And I've never worked with someone who talks as much as Martha. So from the moment I greet her in the waiting room to the moment the session ends, even after the session ends, as I'm rising from my seat, as I'm walking into the door, as I'm opening the door, as I'm closing the door, Martha is talking. I'm generally not someone who finds it difficult to get a word in. You know, I would consider myself a fair bit of a talker. And I certainly don't begrudge people talking in therapy. I think a lot of people I see talk a lot, and that's fine. But, yeah, with Martha, I just feel like she holds me captive with her talking, and it's driving me crazy. When I first met her and when she was so talkative in our first few sessions, I thought she was settling into therapy because, you know, in my experience, it's not that unusual for people to talk a fair bit when they first come to therapy if they're feeling anxious or they've been holding things in. So initially I associated something like a bubbling brook to Martha, and I thought, okay, it feels okay enough and sort of necessary just to sit here and she can bubble along, and that's how we start. But the pace and the consistency of her talking has continued unabated, and now I feel that this bubbling brook has turned into an army tank that rolls over anything that obstructs its forward momentum.
Okay.
And so I'm laughing, but I feel oppressed by her talking, and it feels aggressive to me, right? Yes. I sort of feel pinned to the mat by Martha's talking. And I've tried so many different approaches to working with her talking. So I've interrupted her on multiple occasions, and I have to interrupt because she doesn't stop to draw breath. I've tried to slow her down and to get a sense of what's happening for her beneath the chatter. Sometimes when I've talked, I've put out both of my hands in front of me and I've pushed towards her as if I'm pushing like a mattress into a wardrobe or something. I've pointed out Martha's talking to her, and I've wondered with her about what it might mean and what's happening for her. Like, is she feeling anxious, or is she like, what is going on? Nothing seems to have any impact. And what usually happens is that Martha will agree with me in a way that feels as though she's taken in none of what I've said. So in a way that just sort of pacifies me. And then she launches into the next topic. So once I asked her if she was interested in having a conversation with me or in hearing what I might have to say, or if she preferred just for me to listen without saying anything. And she said, I don't mind, whatever you'd like, and then kept talking. And I interrupted her. I said, Martha, just like, let's slow down and let's just try to work this out together. And she said, okay, yeah, that sounds good. And then kept talking. And I said, Martha, wait, like, let's talk about this together. I was getting kind of exasperated. And she looked annoyed and sort of said in an equally exasperated way, okay, let's talk about this together. Anyway, so what I was saying was, and I just gave up. And so I feel like my hands are tied in this therapy because it almost feels to me like Martha erases my subjectivity in her talking. She had to return to the GP for a re-referral recently, and I took the opportunity to ask her how she found therapy. And she said, it's indispensable. She said, I don't have a space like this anywhere else in my life. And then she continued to talk about feeling taken for granted by her partner. And I found myself sort of thinking, I'm not so sure about that. Like, the way in which you commandeer this space, I really don't know if you don't have any other space like this. Or if I'm struck by the discrepancy between how I experience her and how she describes experiencing herself. And I wonder if what she says is happening in the outside world, how that relates to what's happening in session, because it feels like there's such a discrepancy. I feel baffled by that. So anyway, my dilemma with Martha is I feel like I continue to feel a strong pressure to intervene and to stem the tide of her talking, but all my attempts have been in vain, and Martha seems unable to take in what I'm saying. Like, she just doesn't seem ready for that, for any kind of intervention. And I think my urge to intervene is because I'm feeling increasingly impatient with tolerating my growing feeling of being aggrieved at her talking. And I'm also feeling impatient at bearing what I feel is this aggressive attack that renders me powerless and sort of unseats me from my position or my role as therapist. I feel frustrated when she talks about having difficulty finding a voice and taking space for herself in the outside world, because I feel her voice is so loud and so dominant in session and she takes up so much space. So I just, I can't get that discrepancy. When she complains about everything falling to her and her family, I want to say, listen, like you won't even let me talk in here. And when I work hard to try to say anything, you don't take it in. So how do you expect anyone to help you when your aggression renders them so passive in your presence? And I also feel like the therapy is sort of ineffective. I feel like we're wasting our time, wasting her money. And at the same time, I'm thinking of people like Robert Grossmark and his idea of the flow of an active engagement, and Jessica Benjamin and her idea of surrender. And I'm thinking maybe this is something I just have to roll with and tolerate for longer. Maybe allowing myself to do that will help me feel less frustrated about it. So yes. I'm not sure where to go, but I'm going to stop talking now. I'll stop my wall of sound.
Andy, there was a bit that it's interesting because I also felt, I didn't feel you were a wall of sound, but I did feel that there was an urgency and a pressure to actually let me know how frustrating and how difficult it is. So I did actually experience that. Now when you said, I'll stop talking and stop being a wall of sound, I didn't experience you as a wall of sound.
It's a relief, right?
But it's interesting because I didn't interrupt you and I did feel free. I could have because I chose not to. But that's interesting that I didn't, because I was responding to the pressure of expressing the frustration and getting through it. But I am going to ask you now. You were talking about the discrepancy at some point, and there were two discrepancies and I didn't quite catch it. The one was the discrepancy between how she presents in the room, taking up all the space, and what she says outside the room, which is that she has no space. But there was another discrepancy, and
It was the same discrepancy. I was just referencing that first discrepancy again when I was saying, because I get frustrated when she says, I just, you know, I can't find my voice, I can't take space for myself. And I think, really? Like that is not the case in here.
Yes. And so, you know, we do wonder about what the reality is out there. I do find myself wondering that too. On the other hand, I was really struck by when you said she erases your subjectivity.
No, she erases my subjectivity.
Yeah, she erases your subjectivity.
Oh, I thought you said her subjectivity. No. Sorry, look at me.
That's what you said to me, that you feel that she erases it. And I thought, yes. And that certainly is a projective identification of her subjective experience, not necessarily the objective reality. Out there, she might be doing a lot of talking and taking up a lot of space and driving them all mad, as you suspect. How can they, you know, help you when you render them so passive? So that might be the objective reality, but her subjective reality is that her subjectivity is actually erased. But I was struck by you saying that you feel your subjectivity is erased, and it certainly did feel like that in the way you described it. So I do wonder about that as a projective identification, the objective reality notwithstanding, and of course the objective reality is important. I did find myself, both in acting, because I didn't interrupt you at that point when you actually were talking about the discrepancy, and I wanted to clarify something then, and I suspect I haven't fully clarified what I wanted to, but it's irrelevant, doesn't matter. So I am struck by the fact that that happened. And I did surrender, actually, in that moment to the fact that it did seem important for you to be able to express how frustrated you feel. And I get it, because if I had to listen to that, you know, week after week after week, it would be incredibly frustrating. But I suspect that you are going to have to surrender because you've tried everything. It's not like you haven't tried. Anything I will tell you, you will have already tried. And I would say she might be in the grip of the drive that there's some pleasure in pinning you, but I suspect not. I think she's caught in a pressure of speech And in the same way, as I always say to people, don't stand in front of the draft because you'll get run over, I would say don't stand in front of the babbling brook because it's gathering into a waterfall and you'll go over the edge with it. And I think you're quite close to the edge as it is. And I do think that when she says it's indispensable, that is her subjective experience. I think that in that family of five, and there was some awful domestic violence, and I'm sure that the parents were preoccupied with their troubles and their conflicts, she was completely overlooked. So she has not, as I'm imagining it, she hasn't been heard, she hasn't been recognized. And yes, I mean, you are a bit of a captive audience, but I think for the first time in her life, she's actually having the experience of attentive listening, because even though I can hear you frustrated, I can also hear you still kind of listening, thinking, even though your thoughts are about, oh my God, there's such a discrepancy. I can't imagine how awful it is if this is how you're carrying on at home, et cetera, et cetera. But you're still thinking about her very actively in that moment. And you are listening to her, and I don't think she's ever had that experience. So I think she comes in starving and horror of horrors. And, of course, it's completely and totally unrealistic, and you'll definitely not welcome it. She's the kind of patient that needs to come five times a week so that you can get rid of all of this in order to get underneath. But once every second week, she's got this whole backlog that's actually built up. But I really don't think that you're doing nothing, because when you ask that question a bit plaintively, not even a bit frustratedly, why is she coming to therapy? Because you're giving her a huge amount of things that she's never had before. So she, for me, goes into a patient who's in deficit. The problem, of course, is that it's a bit of a bottomless sort of pit, because there is such deficit. But don't underestimate what you're giving her, is what I'm saying. And if you can then, I do think you're going to have to go the way of surrender. And if you can know that and then be a little bit less hard on yourself about, I have to be doing something and I need to be interrupting or changing it or getting her, I honestly think that anything I can tell you, I bet you anything you like, you've tried.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I feel like it's unlocked something for me, what you were saying about the difference between her subjective reality or her subjective experience of herself and what might be the objective reality. I think I was getting so caught in the frustrations with what I experience as the objective reality, I was forgetting about her experience of herself, which is sort of mirrored in my experience of having my subjectivity erased. And it's interesting, you know, because there is something about, like, even if she is that way in the outside world, there's something about that kind of constant talking that does obscure something about who she is.
Yes.
You know, it's like she can be very, like, objectively, she can take up a lot of room. But there's something that feels that
that's such a good point. That's such a good point, because you still don't get to something where, again, using Jessica Benjamin, recognition, there's something about that it's so hard to really get to recognition of other sort of aspects of her. I suspect that, you know, change the countertransference, you change the patient. As I think, as you begin to think differently about her, and it's going to be an internal process that will shift her, if anything can actually shift her. And that word erase, because, yes, you know, you're erased. She feels erased, certainly. And in domestic violence, people are erased. And, you know, so erasure for me is a key word. And also the idea of the wall of sound, because the wall of sound, in a way, is actually blocking out. You know, it's not carrying it. It's actually blocking something out around recognition. But you're not going to hold that wall or that river back. You know, with a damn wall, one's going to have to let her kind of roll on for a bit, surrender, And I think to try to shift something in your internal world and then let's see, you know, what actually happens.
Yeah.
Just one quick question, because we're toward the end. Is the content all the time about the failure of recognition in her current situation?
That's so interesting, yes.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the problem is the problem is the problem. So she experiences the failure of recognition and she insists on bringing it to you. And you, I think, will get to a point where it's possible for other things about her to be recognized.
Yes.
And to just slip them in. I notice this about you. And then just plant the seed and let her go on.
Do you know, I just had this thought too, before when you were saying that you feel like I'm sort of listening to her attentively, I think that has decreased the amount of time we've been working together, because as my frustration increases, I get more and more distracted by that and I find it harder and harder to take in actually what she's saying. So it's so interesting, that failure of recognition, because I feel as though, I hear what you're saying, I think she does come hungry, I think she does come starving, and it's sort of like at the moment I feel like I'm giving her fairy floss or something, like it's not, you know, like it might fill her up, but it's got no nutritional value. But my feeling is now that I've got this different sort of understanding of what's happening for her, I will actually be able to listen in a different way and to kind of recognize her in a different way. That feels to me like, well, that's what she's after.
You're spot on, because the less you're able to actually listen, the more insistent she'll be about wanting the recognition. But I think it's just little things that you might notice that you throw in, and it could be whatever it is, and then she'll barrel on and, you know, to try to notice maybe something on the positive and then say, Martha, I know that you heard me, but I just want to underline, I did say something positive. Okay, can go on now.
Right.
So you don't like try and stop her, but you throw it in and say, I know you heard me and, you know, I want you to, it's a positive, take it in, but okay, we can go on now. So you don't sort of frustrate her, you flow with her, but you have a tiny moment to actually put something in if you can. But the main thing is going to be an internal transformation.
Yeah.
You don't have to work so hard, Andy, is what I'm saying. And even with the attentive listening, you can have a free-floating listening. You don't have to take in every word, because she's repeating a lot of it. But it's like just actually being with her, but not taking in every word, because that's not what it's about.
Yeah. I just had an image of like skimming stones over the water of the babbling brook, you know, can babble for a bit. I like skim a stone every now and then.
Yes, because when you skim a stone, it still sinks, even though it goes across the top.
Yeah.
It still actually goes in. So and we want it to go in.
Yeah.
But lightly. So.
Yeah. Thanks, Jill. I feel like I might be able to do that now. How I feel towards her has changed. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Good.
Great.
Thanks.
Now we reflect on what happened. We identified the dilemma we took into the supervision, the distillation we took out of supervision, and our blind spots.
Blind spots include bright spots and dark spots. A bright spot is when we are blinded to the overall picture and we can only see a sliver of what is occurring in ourselves and in the interaction. A dark spot is when the issues are more completely out of sight. Andy, what was your dilemma going into this?
I think my dilemma was, shush! I felt really held captive and oppressed and made useless by Martha's talking, and I just felt that I couldn't stand it any longer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the distillation?
The distillation for me was that I needed to surrender to the process in a way that allowed things to be easier on her and easier on me, and that opened up a space for recognition.
The tone of your voice sounded so surrendering.
Very different to shush. Yeah.
It had an impact. I can hear it.
Exactly. Yeah.
The blind spots. What was a bright spot, Jill?
Well, Andy, I think that your investment in her and your wish to be helpful to her blinded you to the fact that you were being helpful to her, but in a different way to that which you had envisaged.
Mm-hmm. And the dark spot?
I think Perhaps you were unaware of a parallel process, because I think her experience of being erased was being mirrored in your own experience of being erased. And I think you didn't quite see that it was a communication from her and a plea for recognition.
Mm-hmm. And what were your learning points, Andy?
Yeah, I think just going from that dark spot, really, I think my first learning point was the difference between subjective experience and external reality. So separating out how Martha experiences herself from how I experience her really helped me deal with the frustration I was feeling about this apparent discrepancy. And the second learning point for me was that sometimes a deficit can manifest as an excess. Martha's excess of talking was actually a mark of her deprivation.
Yeah. And what were your teaching points, Jill?
Well, I think the first one is that if the therapist has a meaning framework to think about the patient, it can contain some of the difficult feelings. So, Andy, when you said that you understood she was coming from a deficit, it actually helped you to feel less frustrated because you had some framework in which to make meaning of what was happening. So I think that's important. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is a tolerance of otherness, because I think you had a preconception of how you would be helpful, but it wasn't Martha's idea of what would be helpful. And that difference had to be accepted and tolerated.
Mm. And a final question, Andy.
Yeah, Jill, I think my final question for you is just wondering what you make of Martha's relationship with alcohol and with shoplifting.
That's a great question, and I'm pleased you brought that in. I think that the beauty of psychoanalysis is that it really looks at the idiosyncratic, and I think alcohol and shoplifting can serve many different functions. But I think that for Martha specifically, I think that the shoplifting and the alcohol were filling a deficit. Whereas for others, for example, shoplifting could be about transgression, alcohol could be about managing social anxiety. But I think for Martha, the shoplifting was about stealing something that at some level she felt was her birthright and that she hadn't been given. And I think that the alcohol was filling herself up on something, but also numbing out painful and difficult feelings in the same way that the words were numbing out painful feelings. So again, these two behaviours, really, shoplifting and drinking alcohol, can have many different meanings, which is why it's vital that we keep three associating.
Thank you for listening to Three Associating. Our theme song is performed by Katie Whiten, and our audio production is by Jared Young. So a big thank you to both Katie and Jared. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating and review on whichever platform you listen to us. We love hearing from you and appreciate all of the support we've had so far. This really helps us to continue to make new content.
Bye for now. What is the loneliest number?